Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And folks, it is now or never. As we start realizing what we really have to do, I mean, it's not necessarily something that is heavy-hearted to do. We have the capacity to do all of this. It's just the real question is, are we adults enough to actually take control and actually take back our self-government? I believe we do, and I believe there's a lot of people that kind of realize, you know, that, well, maybe not enough people. I don't know, Paul, what do you think? Do you think bringing Paul back into this, because I don't want to get a chance to, when I speculate like this, I may be wrong, but, you know, I believe most people want a self-government. They want that. And so, go ahead.
I think there are enough. I think they're not sure what to do. There are people out there fighting now. They're fighting in all these different directions. And my direction, which you and I agree on, is that we need to unite on the Constitution. Right. I'm telling you, when I share this message, eyes light up.
Yeah.
Okay. I think there are enough people. And one of the other things I say, and this is kind of a biblical reference, I say to my audiences, I continue to do this because I yet believe there's still more than 10 righteous people in America. You know what I mean? So the reference is to
Sodom and Gomorrah.
You know, you're Sodom and Gomorrah.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so it's worth the effort to reach out to people because there are people who are looking for solutions and uniting on the Constitution.
Okay,
so full compliance with the Constitution is a solution.
Right. So the question that I'm kind of thinking, because I don't think a lot of people may not understand that, you know, a self-government means that we kind of have to police ourselves. We have to enforce these laws ourselves. You know, do you really want a foreign entity to, you know, inflict laws upon us? You know, because the concept of inflicting, the only way bad laws will ever be enforced is if we surrender our self-government to somebody else, to a professional government, to this globalist that's going to become the big teat of mankind. And to be clear, folks, you have to understand, for them to become the big teat of mankind, they have to kill billions of people. Because they want to get us down to something more manageable. They realize that they need to have enough control, and there's way too many people. They just can't control all of us right now.
Right.
And in other words, there's not enough people on their side with the ability to force. Now, they've got idiots here in America that are moving forward. We need to rise up and say, no, we will govern ourselves, and we will prove so by actually enforcing the laws for ourselves.
Right.
Because we have to do it.
That's in the design.
That is in the design. It's just that we've never been taught these fundamentals of the design. So as we were kind of ending up yesterday, and so I'm just going to kind of go over this, that in this exclusive territory, Nicholas brought up this concept that this is the only land that the federal government has full control over, permanent full control over. All other land is basically to be seceded by states for very specific purposes and on temporary basis. In other words, it's not to be permanent, which is why the federal government doesn't own these military installations around the United States. They lease the land from the states. Even if the states like Nevada, so because this comes up, even if the state of Nevada seceded land, grasslands, and, you know, good part of Nevada to rent and, you know, allow the federal government to pay them to use this, what they thought at the point in time when they became a state was a bunch of barren, you know, nothing land, then, you know, even if they are okay with doing that, The Constitution does not give the federal government the authority to do it. So even if the federal government had paid the state of Nevada for these leases and they're paying them on an annual basis, all we need to do, folks, is stand up and say, hey, federal government, you don't have the authority to possess that land. You may have Nevada renting it to you, but they can't rent it to you because you don't have the authority for those purposes. So cease and desist. Wow. It's that simple. Mm. It's that simple. And so we were kind of talking about, you know, that there was the same security with this. I'm just rereading what Nicholas said because, you know, people may not remember all of this because this kind of carried out this concept of the ability for the federal government to create Indian reservations and reservations for parks and, you know, forests and all these other things. And so he says this, there was the same security with respect to the places purchased for the erection of forts, magazines, and etc. And as the territory of the United States, the power of Congress shall only extend to make needful rules and regulations concerning it, without prejudicing the claim of any particular state. The right of territory not being given up, that the grant of those lands to the United States was for the general benefit of all the states and not to be perverted to their prejudice. That consequently, whether that country were formed into new states or not, the danger apprehended could not take place, that the seat of government was to be still a part of the state, and as to general regulations was to be considered as such. And so even though it's still a part of the state, it is an autonomous part of the state. In other words, the general government, or I should say the state government, see, this didn't happen. What they ended up doing was they didn't put the Washington, D.C. smack dab in the middle of a state where it was surrounded by one particular state. They actually seceded this little, you know, territory on this border between Maryland and Virginia and created a small little miniature state for the United States. So they weren't necessarily surrounded, and they had their own port of entry for ships and so forth to actually go up the Potomac and get to D.C. And so this is why it was really an ideal placement for their time, because the nature of the ships that they had back in those days, they were so shallow they could actually go up rivers in those things.
Correct.
And so anyway. Which now I think it's outlived its purpose now. I honestly think that because we have technology, we don't need a full capital that we have for Congress. I believe that, you know, as we look at, you know, what way to go forward, I believe if the framers had the technology and the ability today, they would absolutely be, you know, making sure that your representation was maintained back at the state. And the state houses would have more control. You know, here's the question. Do the state houses need to have a Senate? Yeah, I guess they do. They do need to have senators because they have to go through the treaties and all those other things. So they need somebody full time to do that. But do they need to sit in Washington, D.C. anymore? No. And as a matter of fact, not even for classified natures, because if the state houses bring the Senate back, because they have to deal with all of these representatives, right, that are no longer going to fit into that Capitol building because we're now going to have 7,000-8,000 representatives. Then, right. Okay, so now what do we do? Okay, well, the state houses would then create, you know, these little side buildings for the federal government. And that would be leased for and paid for by the federal government, where they would have the skiffs and everything else. And we'd create more of a symbiotic relationship between the states and the federal government by having it local and by making everybody attainable and quick to be, you know, engaging with their representatives.
Sure.
There's no reason why they wouldn't have done that. Go ahead.
You use the term skiff. Would you explain that again?
Sensitive compartmented information facilities for highly classified material.
Okay. So each state would have one of those.
Well, each state has them. I think every state in the union has a SCIF for one purpose or another, whether it's for whether it's a defense contractor that possesses it. I'm just saying SCIFs exist in every state, I believe. If there's a military base, they've got some. They probably have a SCIF.
Okay. All right. Fascinating. All right. So yesterday we brought up something about Jefferson's draft. Was this the one that was done in 1803?
Yes.
Was that what you're talking about?
Precisely. So in regards to the territory, remember, Jefferson recognized that the Constitution did not give the states the ability to take a territory and just create an Indian nation, an Indian state, a state strictly for the Indians within the United States. So this is what Jefferson basically did. He submitted this amendment to the Constitution to Congress, and this is what it said. The province of Louisiana is incorporated with the United States and made part thereof. The rights of occupancy in the soil and of self-government are confirmed to the Indian inhabitants as they now exist. Preemption only of the portions rightfully occupied by them and a cession to the occupancy of such that may abandon with full rights of possession as well as property and sovereignty in whatever or so shall cease to be so rightfully occupied by them shall belong to the United States. The legislature of the Union, I'm not going to go into the details of what all this stuff means, but he's literally laying out this amendment to actually give Indians land. And, so that the federal government has the power to do that. Well, if they didn't have the power to give this land, and let me go, because there's three paragraphs. That was just the first paragraph. The legislature of the Union, Congress, shall have authority to exchange the right of occupancy in portions where the United States have full rights for lands possessed by Indians within the United States on the east side of the Mississippi. So in other words, where the Indians now exist within, the same areas like, the Cherokee and so forth, to exchange lands on the east side of the river for those on the west side thereof and above the latitude of 31 degrees to maintain in any part of the province such military posts may be requisite for peace or safety to exercise police over all persons therein. See, these powers don't exist in the Constitution. He wants the federal government to have these powers. Not right. Being Indian inhabitants to work salt springs or mines of coal. So in other words, he's kind of creating Indian lands, and he's also creating, the needful use of the resources, salt mines and so forth for the United States. And all of the inhabitants and all of the persons to explore and ascertain the geography of the province, its productions and other interests and circumstances to open roads and navigations therein where necessary and beneficial communication and establish agencies and factories therein for the cultivation of commerce, peace and good understanding with the Indians residing there. The legislature shall have no authority to dispose of the lands of the province otherwise than is hereinbefore permitted until a new amendment of the Constitution shall give that authority, except as to the portion thereof which lies south of the latitude of 31 degrees. So in other words, the land to the north, I think the 31 degrees is right there in New Mexico. Going across that way. And he's talking about basically the majority of the Louisiana Purchase he wanted to set aside for the Indians to kind of, figure out what land that they wanted to have and use. And then, the United States would still have access to the salt mines and the minerals and those types of things that the Indians just don't care about.
So that's interesting. So apparently what Jefferson Woodson wanted to do was create constitutionally a province where Indians would reside, I guess wherever they were in that particular area, and the United States would cede that land to them as their territory.
Right, but it would still be a part of the United States because it's not like they're surrendering it completely. That they would still have some authority over it. So my point is this. he was providing an amendment because this power didn't exist.
Right.
So the power to actually have and control the lands for Indians did not exist in the Constitution, which is why he felt it was necessary. And instead of creating Indian reservations and helping isolate, you know, Indians, you know, in the existing states into reservations, this is what he proposed, because they couldn't do it, which is why they ended up, you know, with Jackson, you know, suffering under the, you know, the tyranny of him for the Trail of Tears and kicking, you know, tens of thousands of Indians out of the South.
So here's a question. There wasn't the authority to do that then. There isn't currently the authority to do that. What would be our position with Indians or Native Americans today?
Well, so our appropriate relationship should actually completely reverse, and all land that the Indians possess goes to the states, because that's actually state land. And okay. That it is my recommendation that the Indians, all federal controls end immediately, and that those lands that have been federal lands actually be plotted out and be designated to each Indian family, so that they possess as equal as possible a breakup of that land. In other words, right now, the way the tribes have it is that whoever the elders of the tribe, because it's different in each case, as a matter of fact, but we have to basically kind of help divvy up that land so that every Indian, every family, every, you know, person of the descendant of that tribe, you know, has a parcel of land that is given them. And they can do with that land what they want to do with that land. And if I was the states, I would basically provide a some type of a temporary gap of not having any taxes on the land. So if they don't want to be taxed, you know, because they have really productive land or whatever, then they could sell that land. And they can, mm-hmm. if they want to, you know, go anywhere they want, if they want, because the question is, because I know that there are tribes, and I don't want to be naive that I know and understand all of it. I don't. But bottom line is, you have to let them have, you know, control of their own destiny and control of their own land. And so, the reality is that we as a people on this planet have grown, and the reality of sovereignty has really been settled a long, long time ago with the laws of nations, which is how, mm-hmm. you know, we assumed and consumed all of this land. And as a civil entity operating within the laws that, you know, were governing all states of the world under the laws of nations, we basically, you know, complied with those laws. And actually, we were one of the very few nations that did.
Tell me what you mean.
Well, so
one of the few nations that did.
Well, so when you look at how Portugal and how Spain treated the indigenous people, the Indians or what have you, in South America, Central America, and so forth, and, you know, even the French and on and on. Now, you know, it really annoys me when we see the propaganda that, you know, we killed so many with, you know, smallpox and so forth. I highly recommend, because I'm not going to get into the numbers, as they did in an American Patriot history, a Patriot's History of the America or whatever. It's by Sikord and Allen. These guys were, and I probably mispronounced that, but they actually challenged the concept that, you know, more people died on this continent than what died on Europe, because the diseases that they brought back from the people that were here was far, took more of a toll on Europe than it did on the people here. Yet, so clearly, we had this what we call this intermingling of societies where we had, you know, people, you know, that had their own unique germs and so forth intermingling with other people that had theirs, and it was symbiotically shared. Maybe it wasn't beneficial, but it was shared. What we shared with them, they shared with us equally. And if you actually go through, you know, who suffered the most, because the numbers, these guys challenged it, and there's actually no evidence that proves that many people died. As a matter of fact, there is zero mass graves.
Wow. Yeah, I found it. It's called A Patriot's History of the United States from Columbus' Great Discovery to yes. America's Age of Enlightenment
yes.
by Larry Schweikert and Michael Allen.
There you go. And those guys, okay. they see the progressives have gotten away with spewing all of these falsehoods. And so everybody's, you know, been indoctrinated into, well, that's what's the truth is that, you know, white man, you know, did all of these terrible things. And I'm going, are you kidding me? You know, you see this crap in the movies. You see it in entertainment. You see it in the news. You see it in the classroom. And it's all about white guilt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, here's the interesting thing. Who's doing this? I mean, it's not like, do you know of any black historians that were actively trying to rewrite history to, you know, create white guilt? The white guilt came from the white people, because you understand what I'm saying? In other words, the revisionist of history, it's always been a dark, evil side that has been existing from the beginning of the European Illuminati and so forth, because they have a plan. They have a plan to subjugate us. And it's been a very gradual process. Had they actually done this, you know, with a burning of documents and a burning of and so forth, they would have been rooted out, they would have been exposed, and they would have been killed. And there would be no more Illuminati, there would have been no more plan. They knew they had to go slowly, methodically, and little by little, they would successfully boil the frogs of every nation. And that's what they've been getting away with. But the fact is that these are Europeans that were behind and concocting all of this, just these atrocities against mankind. Right. Anyway, because, you know, I mean, there's lots of people that have been benefiting, whether they be black, Hispanic, it doesn't matter, right? There's I'm an opportunist. And if these guys want to, you know, pervert their history, their own history, so that they can do bad things, hey, I'm in on that. Because, you know, I want to be, I'm an opportunist, and I want to have an opportunity here. And that's what La Raza and all of these other organizations are, because they're being fed. They're all about dividing and conquering. You know, you want to create a new form of division. I'm sure money will come your way so that you can actually, you know, provide more divisiveness and keeping us from uniting, because that's what it's all about. Keeping us from uniting.
Yep. Anyway. That's correct.
Anyway, so we're going into a break, believe it or not. We covered the rereading and then this amendment. Hopefully we've covered this. So do you have any other things we want to bring up? Because we got about 10 seconds.
No, not at the moment. Let's move on.
Okay, so we'll go into the break, and then when we come back, we'll pick up more of the Virginia ratification debates right after that. So, folks, I'm hoping that this, you know, that this made sense. I want to make sure. So when we come back, I'll actually ask Paul that I answered all the questions. So Paul, think about that while we're out going to break. And like I said, we'll figure out if everything was truly answered or not. I think we did, but we'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
Yeah. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so let's be clear here, because what we were covering out of this portion that Nicholas was talking about is that the whole point that the federal government was to have this stewardship over this land wasn't to be able to benefit the world. In other words, this concept of citizens of the world, we owe it to the world. No, we only owe it to those states that are a part of this government, that is to for them and their benefit, and not to prejudice against their claims, not to create prejudice against their claims or give an advantage to the federal government over them. And what has actually happened is the federal government has taken advantages. Woo, bless you. That's probably one of those allergy sneezes. I know it's tough there in Missouri with all the pollen and all the allergy seasons. I'm glad I don't live in a place that I would be allergic to. So go ahead.
Yeah, my allergies hit me in May and August, and the May season seems to be extended. And so I'll try to mute myself when I know I'm about to have a sneezing fit.
Yeah, sometimes I get it. It happens. So Kazuntite.
Thank you.
Anyway, okay. So Nicholas was basically spelling out that they could only possess this land for very specific purposes, to serve the Union. The reason they would have military, not to suppress and control the Union, but to serve them. The only reason they had these territories was to serve the Union, to help actually help develop these territories so that they would become states where they would actually be able to produce on their own the needed coal, the needed salt, the needed, you know, copper and minerals and those types of things that would facilitate the growth of the Union. And voila, I mean, it was a perfect plan. But Jefferson realized that, hey, we've got all of this land. Let's take and give the federal government the ability to give land and kind of, you know, have some control over that so that we could, you know, let the Indians thrive in an area with minimal regulations other than the fact that, you know, we'll be able to mine salt and those types of things, because he talked about owning the soil.
So let me ask you a question. Sure. You said something about salt not being important to the Indians. I had not considered that.
So there may have been some Indians, like maybe the Adobe, that were doing some mining, but I was never aware of any mining operations that were done, because the American Indians were really more, I would just say, more of a nomadic type of people.
Okay. Right. So they weren't necessarily miners. You know, they lived off of what was produced on the land, I guess,
sure.
Correct?
Yes, correct. And so they, you know, they were hunters and gatherers, and, you know, in essence, they lived a primitive life. They didn't own land. They didn't till the land. They did not have dominion. Well, they had dominion over those things that crawled upon the earth, but they were not farmers. For the most part, not that they weren't, But for the most part, they didn't, you know, possess fields of great agricultural operations.
Okay. All right. I guess the concept, from what I understand from the early times of them, you know, meeting the new, you know, the explorers that were coming over here, they considered land ownership as kind of strange because
yes.
the land, yeah.
Well, so that was a little bit different, though. To be clear, the Mohicans mm-hmm. and some of the northeastern Indian tribes, they lived in a land, I would just call it, of milk and honey and plenty. In other words, they lived in a kind of a mild climate, even though they had, you know, they could get some harsh winters. It was kind of a mild climate to where they were able to harvest, you know, the ready fruits and the foods that kind of grew in a wild form.
Okay.
Does that make sense? And so if you go to the sure. adobe, if you go to the areas of the adobe, they actually built, you know, homes into the rocks and, you know, they built their own homes. They weren't as nomadic, you know. So there were a lot of different, you know, how tribes, you know, chose and went down a path of how they were going to sustain themselves. Each of them took their own path.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to me, it was almost like this religious culture.
Okay.
And anyway, I'm definitely not the subject matter expert on it, but I do know
okay.
that you're right, that they didn't fathom owning land. They would migrate, that when the winters came, that they would probably migrate to the south.
Okay.
Go ahead.
All right. So we just got done with Mr. Nicholas Exclusive. Was that right?
That is correct.
Or were we beyond that?
That is. So we're on Madison's note. Yes.
Okay. All right, so I'm ready when you are.
So go ahead. Go ahead. So you're going to notice in the middle of this, I'm sorry for the interruption. You're going to notice in the middle yeah. of this, you see this little paragraph that kind of speaks, you know, this little point that they couldn't give you everything that Madison said because he spoke too okay. low. They couldn't hear him. So we have no idea what we didn't okay. capture here. So go ahead.
Okay. The honorable member asks, why ask for this power, and if the subsequent clause be not fully competent for the same purpose? If so, what new terrors can arise from this particular clause? It is only a superfluity. If that latitude of construction which he contends for were to take place with respect to the sweeping clause, there would be room for those horrors. But it gives no supplementary power. It only enables them to execute the delegated powers. If the delegation of their powers be safe, no possible convenience can arise from this cause. Are they talking about the necessary and proper clause?
Yeah, the sweeping clause is the necessary and proper clause. And right. so they were also talking about, you know, the combination of the exclusive along with the necessary and proper, correct. The exclusive legislation right. over the district, because I'll pull it up here. As I look at the last couple of things within it, you have the exclusive legislation and then the final, you know, power or the final clause in Article 1, Section 8 is the necessary and proper clause.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. It is at most but explanatory. For when any power is given, its delegation necessarily involves authority to make laws to execute it. Were it possible to delineate on paper all those particular cases and circumstances in which legislation by the general legislature would be necessary and leave to the states all the other powers, I imagine no gentleman would object to it. But this is not within the limits of human capacity. The particular powers which are found necessary to be given are therefore delegated generally, and particular and minute specification is left to the legislature. You know, and then, you know, here Mr. Madison spoke of the distinction between regulation of police and legislation was so low he could not be heard. All right. when the honorable member objects to giving the general government jurisdiction over the place of their session, does he mean that it should be under the control of any particular state? That might, at a critical moment, seize it. I should have thought that this clause would have met with the most cordial approbation, as the consent of the state in which it may be, must be obtained, and as it may stipulate the terms of the grant, should they violate the particular stipulations, it would be an usurpation, so that if the members of Congress were to be guided by the laws of their country, none of those dangers could arise. And then, of course, he made several other remarks which could not be heard. Now, that was a mouthful, and I've got to ask you a question, kind of unrelated. Well, related and maybe unrelated. You'll understand what I mean.
Okay.
Throughout the ratification debates, we have these discourses recorded in specificity.
Yep.
I have to ask myself, were there a team of people recording these things? Because these are not, first of all, Americans don't speak this way currently. You understand what I'm saying? So what happens is someone's recording this information, and they're getting it right, because you can't do this by accident.
Well, so they not only got it right, but they all went through. So after the delegates had finally made the determination, then they all kind of went through the recorders. You know, in other words, they looked at the text, and there was some scrutiny as to whether they captured, whether there was this accuracy or not. And in some respects, you know, everybody basically conceded. They all conceded that the record was sufficient in covering what they had. Not everybody was pleased, because there were things that either were missed or they were misaccounted for. So there may have been some things that may have been corrected for the record because it was important. Right. And some things weren't corrected because, you know, there wasn't enough either evidence to make those corrections, because, you know, Henry couldn't go along and correct what Madison said. And so Madison had the ability to provide feedback on what they said he said. And, you know, each orator kind of had a responsibility to proofread what these guys stated. And for the most part, this was, you know, not just done in a vacuum and then published. It was done, it was proofread, and then published.
Well, and in some cases, like we see two cases in Madison here, he spoke so low, couldn't be recorded by whoever was doing the recording, or whoever was doing the transcribing. So my question is, I'm trying to picture this in my mind. There must be two or three people who are writing down as fast as they can, okay, what they're hearing, and then everyone's comparing notes, and then it gets reviewed before it's published. That's what I'm picturing in my head. Okay.
Yes, you're right. It's like stenographers, right? But instead of just one, you know, because, you know, when you're done with testimony, because it was flying that fast, they probably had a little three people recording, mm-hmm. so that one person could record what was being said. And then the next person up, while they were, you know, tidying up all the notes and what they were still writing, the next person that would get up would be recorded by another person. And, you know, then they would kind of, you know, and then the next person would kind of step in. Or they may have had one person that kind of took maybe notes of what was being said and what was going on, you know, by the general body. But
go
ahead.
Well, it's kind of impressive, GR, because this is pre-stenography, pre-technology, and they're getting the nuances of this debate so that we can have it.
Well, so they were. So here's the interesting thing. Why were they so impressed in capturing these records?
Apparently, they wanted us to have them.
Apparently, something inspired them that they would be needed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And that's the truth. That's the whole truth right there, that, you know, only the Lord knew how important these particular documents were because of what was stated, where the Federalist Papers do not give you these details.
That is correct.
That is correct. Okay. So.
Okay.
So we covered Madison's note. Now we go down to Mr. Pendleton, where he talks a little bit more about this. See, you know, out of all of the states, there's a lot of talk about this exclusive legislation.
Mm-hmm.
There you go.
Okay. All right. Mr. Pendleton, okay, is speaking. Mr. Chairman, this clause does not give Congress power to impede the operation of any part of the Constitution or to make any regulation that may affect the interests of the citizens of the Union at large. But it gives them power over the local police of the place so as to be secured from any interruption in their proceedings. Notwithstanding the violent attack upon it, I believe, sir, this is the fair construction of the clause. Okay, he's referring to a violent attack upon the clause. All right, so this must have had a lot of opposition, okay?
Yes.
Because he says, notwithstanding the violent attack upon it, I believe this is the fair construction of the clause.
Okay. Right, so he's basically stepping in, because I like, before you started reading, I said there was a lot of discussion over this one particular part of the Constitution, you know, that they had this exclusive power. I think, you know, if, you know, when you look at what Mason said, Mason was always kind of creating this imagery, this metaphor of, you know, the witches standing over a cauldron and creating a brew of evil. And so, you know, this got people, when Mason created some of those insinuations, or he threw those insinuations out there, it got a lot of people, because he was a very influential man in Virginia. Just same thing as Henry.
Okay.
And so a lot of people really started looking at what this really meant. So as both Nicholas and Madison were fielding these things, I even think Randolph did, Pendleton finally stands up and says, okay, this, you know, this is my opinion. This is what I've garnered so far. Here you go.
Okay. So notwithstanding the violent attack upon it, I believe, sir, this is the fair construction of the clause. It gives them power of exclusive legislation in any case within that district. What is the meaning of this? What is it supposed to do? Is it opposed to the general powers of the federal legislature or to those of the state legislatures? I understand it is opposed to the legislative power of that state where it shall be. What then is the power? It is that Congress shall exclusively legislate there in order to serve the police of the place and their own personal independence, that they may not be overawed or insulted, and of course to preserve them in opposition to any attempt by the state where it shall be. This is the fair construction. Can we suppose that in order to effect these salutary ends, Congress will make it an asylum for villains and the vilest characters from all parts of the world? Will it not degrade their own dignity to make it a sanctuary for villains? I hope that no man that will ever compose that Congress will associate with the most profligate characters. Before I go to the next paragraph, here's something that's what it sounds like to me. Congress is a city council for the District of Columbia.
Yep. And the fact that they've created, they're the city council, you know, they're the governors of all laws to be created. And so this is how it was described. So in other words, this is Congress's job and responsibility, that when they created the District of Columbia, the government for the city, the mayor and all of that. Remember, who was that mayor? Barry? Mayor Barry, yeah.
Marion Barry.
Marion Barry. Mayor Marion Barry. And so, yeah, I mean, when they created that, this is when they, you know, it really started becoming evident that the government was corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. Suppose, okay, so why oppose this power? Suppose it was contrary to the sense of their constituents to grant exclusive privileges to citizens residing within that place. The effect would be directly in opposition to what he says. It could have no operation without the limits of that district. Were Congress to make a law granting them an exclusive privilege of trading to the East Indies, it could have no effect. It could have no effect the moment it would go without that place, for their exclusive power is confined to that district. Were they to pass such a law, it would be nugatory. That's a word I haven't heard before. And every member of the community at large could trade to the East Indies as well as the citizens of that district. This exclusive power is limited to that place solely for their own preservation, which all gentlemen allow to be necessary.
So, in other words, if the federal government started creating its own corporations and started creating its own industry within that district of, you know, 10 by 10, then, you know, all they were saying, well, these guys could actually start selling their wares and doing their own exclusive trades and those. And so, yeah, but it.
Are they not correct?
Well, so. It, they couldn't have exclusive trade over, because look at it. I mean, how much food can D.C. create? How much, you know, minerals, you know, can D.C. mine out of its ground and so forth? What it basically is and how it's corrupting is by the granting of privileges and favors and those things that are, you know, okay, we will, you know, we will support, you know, OPEC. Allowing OPEC to exist and allowing the United States to deal with a a conglomeration of states over the controlling of the prices of oil was, you know, it's antithetical. It's like, you know, it's a cartel dealing with a cartel.
Right.
Right. And the United States should never have, you know, even though these cartels went down that path, we and are dealing with OPEC, we just should shut them out. And just think about it. If the United States was actually advanced to a point where, you know, it was, because we talked about this in previous episodes, that if we were enlightened and advanced to a point where many states in the Union were, you know, we were spread out into Europe and into Asia. You know, how effective would these cartels be? They would have been, they're efficacious. They would not have been as efficacious as they are today.
Sure.
Right. And it's only because the federal government allows for, because it feeds their services or it feeds their purpose by maintaining more and more division because it forces more control.
Right.
Right.
Most interesting. Okay. So here's George Mason again. Wait a minute. Did I miss anything?
No. Exclusive. No.
Okay. It looks like we're going to George Mason and the sweeping clause.
And some and the comments on jurisdiction. Yeah. Right.
Okay. So here we go. Mr. Chairman, gentlemen say there is no new power given by this clause. Is there anything in this Constitution which secures to the states the powers which are said to be retained? Will powers remain to the states which were not expressly guarded or reserved? I will suppose a case. Gentlemen may call it an impossible case and suppose that Congress will act with wisdom and integrity. Among the enumerated powers, Congress are to lay in and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, and to pay the debts and to provide for the general welfare and common defense. And by that clause, so often called the sweeping clause, they are to make all laws necessary to execute those laws. Now, suppose oppressions should arise under this government, and any writer should dare to stand forth and expose to the community at large the abuses of those powers. Could not Congress, under the idea of providing for the general welfare and under their own construction, say that this was destroying the general peace, encouraging sedition, and poisoning the minds of the people? And could they not, in order to provide against this, lay a dangerous restriction on the press? Might they not even bring the trial of this restriction within the 10-mile square when there is no prohibition against it? Might they not thus destroy the trial by jury? Would they not extend their implication? It appears to me that they may and will. And shall the support of our rights depend on the bounty of men whose interest it may be to oppress us? The Congress should have power to provide for the general welfare of the Union, I grant. But I wish a clause in the Constitution with respect to all powers which are not granted, that they are retained by the states. Otherwise, the power of providing for the general welfare may be perverted to its destruction. You know what? This is George Mason. This is the 10th Amendment he's referring to, isn't it?
So, yes. So he's referring to the 10th Amendment. But he's also up here talking about some of the abuses and so forth that actually happened, because he's saying, and could they not, in order to provide against this, lay dangerous restrictions on the press? This actually happened in 1798.
Is this the Alien and Sedition Acts?
The Alien and Sedition Acts, where they basically limited that the press could not speak ill of the government. So, but here's the question. Here's the question. Why was he making this contention? He was making this contention not that it gave them the power to do so, that, you know, they could wander outside that, because clearly when the Alien and Sedition Acts were created, they were quickly identified as unconstitutional by James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. See my point?
Okay.
So what he's arguing here, so this is the, you know, when people get caught up with the anti-federalists were right, because look at what they did that. Now hold on here.
Well, not only would they say they did that, but they say they're doing it now.
But hold on here.
Okay.
Mason is making the point that it would be constitutional, not that they could do it, but it would be legitimately done under the Constitution. And the point, in fact, is that they may do it, but they would be violating the Constitution, which is why this is so important. You have to look at when they were, what they were saying, and, you know, that they would do these things. Yeah, okay, but they would be violating it, and it would cause us to stand up and say, stop. But the problem is we have failed to stand up to say stop. We have failed to do that. So when we
you know what, Jared, that's why we're here today.
That's right. Correct. Absolutely. Absolutely. So now Mason goes on and starts talking about jurisdiction. Go ahead.
Okay. Many gentlemen whom I respect take different sides of this question. We wish this amendment to be introduced to remove our apprehensions. There was a clause in the Confederation reserving to the states, respectively, every power to jurisdiction.
Hey, Paul? Paul, I'm sorry. So, folks, we're going to have to cover this last part in our next episode. So we'll be back tomorrow. And so just make sure that you tune in so that we cover, you know, this very specific clause. And that, you know, hold on, folks. We will be right back after. All right. I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved and supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.